first part of a bumper-sized, jam-packed, two-part Empire podcast this week. We go in the earth with Rhys Shearsmith, hit the heights of In the Heights with Jimmy Smits, and hunt down monsters with Milly Jovovich. All that, plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. It is absolutely positive that Batman would go down. Go down on crime, that is. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, back from an actual day off. It was bliss, folks. My wife and I went to Bath. We ate like a king and a queen. And a shout out to podcast listener Graham Savage, or Savage, I didn't actually ask how he pronounces his surname, who made it possible for Fola and I to attend the theatre. Oh, very nice of him. Much obliged, Graham. I like this day off. I wish to explore the concept further. Anyway, here I am back in it, nose to the grindstone, bringing you more award-nominated, but almost certainly, let's face it, going to be award-losing content. And to do that, I am joined by three colleagues, oh yes, three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
GBFN, James Dyer.
I have to say, I think Batman would come down on crime as opposed to go down on crime. Not to be semantic, but yes, indeed.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Why would he come down on crime?
Well, you know, it's more grammatically pleasing than go down on crime.
Okay, we need to have a long chat about
things. He come down hard on crime and the causes of crime.
You said hard.
Okay, we seriously need to have a chat about your approach and technique.
Like a birds and the bees chat, or a
yes, like
chat.
A birds and the bees chat. In just 2 seconds, as soon as I introduce the other member of our shadowy cabal, he is of course the nicest man in showbiz, especially now that Tom Hanks was found trying to contaminate the entire United States water supply with.
No, Chris,
poison.
No, again.
No.
No, as
no,
a lawyer, that's not
true.
A thing that happened. Absolutely not
true.
True. No.
Okay.
Mm-mm.
I'm pretty sure I saw him.
No, you
standing
didn't.
Over a big
no.
old tank of water with a big old bag saying poison, and he was pouring it in and cackling.
No, I think you've been
he
watching Roadrunner's cartoons again.
He even said, ha 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 ha, I, Tom Hanks,
it,
I'm
no,
poisoning
did it say
the
acne
entire.
Poison? No. Was he dressed up as Wile E. Coyote at the time?
Now I think about it, it might have been a dream. We should, of course, welcome Mr. Ben Travis. Hello, Ben Travis. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. What's this about Batman going down, cracking down on crime, going something about going down on Crime Alley? What's that about?
Is that what they're calling it these days?
Yes,
wow.
That's the only way he will approach a lady's flower. He insists upon them calling it Crime Alley. That's the only way that he will even go down there.
Oh, that's so wrong.
What? What?
It's just so wrong at so many levels.
In fairness, his parents went the same way. So you can see why he
exactly. That's why it's so wrong.
Shane fails in Crime Alley.
Yes. Oh. Anyway, so this is the story that emerged this week, where one of the producers, one of the writers of Harley Quinn season 3 said that Batman, at one point they wanted to have a scene where Batman, how should we say this, pleasured Catwoman orally, and then they were stopped from doing so because apparently that's not what heroes do. Heroes don't do that kind of thing. Now, obviously, Twitter has done its thing and done pretty much every conceivable joke about this. Nevertheless, we're going to have a quick chat about it. And I have to say, Jimbo, what do you mean by come down? The phrase is go down, not come down. And this is a family-friendly podcast, of course.
If you're tackling crime, if you're tackling something, you don't go down on something, you come down on something.
Yeah.
But, like, I come down on crime, I come down on the causes of crime. That is grammar.
Not in this case, because in this case I'm heavily implying
yes.
that he is...
I see what you're implying. I'm simply
yes.
pointing out the flaws in the grammatical structure of your reference.
No, there are no flaws in the grammatical structure of my reference.
Helen?
I would say that, you know, a police force, let's say, cuts down on crime rather than going down on crime. Crime goes down, hopefully, as a result of their efforts, but not, you know... Anyway, there's a subject and an object thing here going on, and it's
oh,
very
there is,
helpful.
All right. Oh, yes.
Batman is too busy figuring out semantics to do what heroes should do.
So what do we think about this? Do we have a theory, grammatical exactitude aside? Do we have a theory about this? I do want to discuss this. I should say that a listener called Fertility Fun, @Fertility Fun, is apparently in labor round about now as she's listening to this, and she has already sent us a tweet saying, I'm going to be in labor next week, so I'm stuck with whatever you do this week on the podcast to listen to whilst I'm having my child, essentially. Could you maybe keep the clangly bang to a minimum?
Oh, God.
And not obsess over Batman going down. See, going down, James, not coming down. Coming down is a very different thing.
Except I'm talking about crime. Thing. You cannot go down on crime.
You can come down on crime.
You can go down on a person.
Yeah, this is
never
the whole point of this debate.
This
is the whole point of the debate. And I'm deliberately using the wrong term for comedic effect. Besides, you can absolutely go down on crime.
If crime were the name of a lady, then I will grant you that point, but not as the abstract noun of crime.
No. Batman is tonguing crime. That's what I'm saying. Batman is giving crime.
Is that a thing that we say?
He's getting a few licks in there, you could say, in the fight against crime.
That's fair. I'll grant you that.
That one works.
All right, we'll do that. We'll do
as
that.
Did
anyway.
Holiest of holies, Batman, which I liked as well.
holiest of holies. So at Fertility Fun, who obviously knows this very, very well, has said, can you not obsess over Batman going down all episodes? So, you know, let's get the foreplay out of the way in the first few minutes and talk about Batman and his stance.
My understanding of this, having sort of read the actual response, was that it was less to do with the fact that they didn't think that it was a manly thing to do, although we should talk about the fact that that is still a perceived notion somewhere, but it was mostly the fact they tried to sell toys and they figured that Batman having performed a sex act would make it more difficult. I mean, yeah, you're not going to have, you know, Cunnilingus Batman and that's going to be your action figure. It seems unlikely that Hasbro are going to go for that, but
fully articulated action figure.
Of course.
Oh god. Although frankly I would buy that.
Why? Never mind. Do we want to know why? Please don't tell me.
It's my collection of, you know, pornographic comic book character toys.
Has coming down on crime action. You press the button.
Do you remember Full Frontal Batman? Do you remember the Full Frontal Batman, the controversial Full Frontal Batman?
I do not know.
No.
So Batman was portrayed full frontal with his Robin out in an issue.
That's
it's absolutely true, in an issue of the comic, and there were complaints, and so the prints of it were altered, so it was in shadow, so you can no longer see it. But if you look
Batman
on the internet, you
Robin
can still
like.
Find yes, you could still find Batman's throbbing in Toto, as it were, not literally, not in the dog Toto.
Oh, that would be, that's a Warner Brothers crossover that won't be in Space Jam 2.
Oh god, this is all going to horribly wrong. But I'm just saying, it's on the internet. If you Google, and I don't recommend it, Batman's knob, you can find the image of Full Frontal Batman from that particular comic. So what I'm saying is the penis has already left the barn, or whatever the metaphor is, and
they're trying
to shut the cod piece after the
cock has bolted. Okay.
Indeed, that's what
James,
I'm saying.
I'm sorry, I've just Googled Batman's knob, and all I've come up with is a couple of links for Etsy and an Amazon link for Batman cabinet furniture. So,
and his batarang is nowhere in sight.
No, nowhere to be seen.
I believe in the evening he calls it his Nightwing. I don't know if that helps.
No, that's also wrong.
That is wrong. I don't like that at all.
Well, because I guess it's a pun on Dick Grayson, but you know, still.
Oh my word!
Still his ward, guys.
Yeah,
come on,
yeah,
Helen.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's
for the ladies.
I think it. Oh God, as
you're the spokesperson of the ladies.
The ladies. I think it's perhaps a little bit more graphic than they were obviously comfortable with. But it is weird, isn't it, that any perceived cunnilingus, frankly, is perceived as being graphic.
Sorry,
in a way that the equivalent is not the other way around. And that has led some really, really odd choices vis-a-vis censorship over the years. So, you know, a film like Boys Don't Cry with implied cunnilingus was much more heavily censored than any number of sort of American Pie-esque films which have implied fellatio. So there's a whole messy history of sexist censorship and sexism in sex acts that is kind of coming into play here. And yes, it does unfortunately put Batman in the same category as DJ Khaled, which is not something that any of us ever really wanted.
No. Congratulations, Batman, you played yourself.
Is coming down on crime what Batman does when he stands on top of those buildings? Is he going full Homelander?
Oh, Ben!
Oh, come on.
Look what Hank's tried to do to the United States water supply, and he's actually moving above you. Apparently he didn't, so there you go. What do I know? But how you're meant to be the nice one, Ben. I was looking forward to explaining sex to you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird.
I didn't mean that. That sounded weird.
Oh, boy. This is getting really confusing.
Anyway, so Helen did obviously bring a serious point to this frankly juvenile and puerile down crime alley.
I'm so sorry.
No, you're
for raising the tone.
No, you are right. You are right to do so, and that's why I brought it up in the first place, Helen. Not so we could get just some cheap gags and some shits and giggles, because we wanted to discuss the depiction of kind of in. You know, because we're all mature adults and we can all say anything. Can't we?
So, and
how it is
so
depicted
adult.
In movies and
or
television.
Or not depicted, yeah.
Or not depicted, yeah.
I mean, in terms of linguistic choices, that is the weird thing about that statement or that response. Like, it's one thing to be like, we don't want there to be footage out there of Batman doing whatever, but to say that's not what heroes do, that is what I take offense at. That feels like just a weird response. Why would you frame it or phrase it in that way?
Yeah, that's where they went super duper wrong, basically, yeah. And made it a sort of a sexist kind of bizarre thing about masculinity and just got really icky about the whole thing. It's, yeah, that up until that point, you know, if they just said, look, we don't want Batman engaging in sex in our cartoons, I feel like people would have been like, I know this isn't a cartoon for adults, but I buy that. Okay, fine. But yeah, that's not what heroes do is a little bit more, are you sure about? Really?
Yeah. Do you really want to be saying that? My favorite tweet, I can't remember who this was from, but my favorite tweet was somebody pointing out that the Batman's cowl literally has handles on the top and it has nothing covering his mouth.
It's purpose design.
Exactly. Come on.
And he was, of course, co-created by Bill Finger.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Anyway, enough of this sexy Batman nonsense. It's getting us far too hot under the collar. There's only one way to cool down, and that is by playing the three-fact structure. Hooray!
What? I thought you said we weren't having it today.
No, I didn't. I said the exact opposite. We're going to give facts a good old licking. James said we weren't having it today, but you know what? He don't call the shots in this one. He called the shots on... James?
The Pilot TV Podcast.
Oh, God. I can't believe I set him up for that one. And that's one I can't cut. Damn it! Yes, so Helen has obviously just learned of the existence of this week's three-fact structure, which is, of course, the section in which we all... Well, my three colleagues of such lethal cunning bring in a fact, formulated fact, to wow and impress me, and I give a point to the winner. Who's up first? Ben, I know that you equally weren't really prepared for this, so I'm going to let you go first.
Well, I did prepare when I then quickly found out that we did have a three-fact structure. And for once, it's not a Disney fact, so it is something else. This was related to... something that I noticed myself when I was watching a couple of films, not super recently, but I watched them not too far apart from each other, and it really stood out to me. And I'm going to be talking about a pretty recent movie, Haunted House. If you've seen David F. Sandberg's really good, underrated horror film, Lights Out, I think that came out 2016, 2017, something around then. It's a super spooky movie about shadow creatures in a house, and it is exactly the same house if you then go and watch, again, the very good, very underrated Ouija Origin of Evil, the prequel film directed by Mike Flanagan. It is the same house, and they use lots of the same kind of corners and nooks and crannies to deliver those scares. And this is the Finnis E. Yoakum House in Highland Park in LA. In Lights Out, they use the interiors and the exteriors. In Ouija Origin of Evil, and I think it's also used in the first Ouija film as well, they just use the interiors, but it's a big kind of creepy old mansion house. Very, very good for spookiness. And in the wake of filming Lights Out, one of the actors, Alexander DiPersia, wondered if they had accidentally cursed this house because they'd been filming a sequence in the basement, a spooky sequence invoking all sorts of spirits in the basement. And a week after that shoot, he got a call from one of his mates saying, oh my God, turn the telly on now, turn on the news. And the house was on fire in a fire emerging from the basement. Thankfully, it was put out pretty quickly and the house remained sort of stable and all of that. But yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting that two very recent horror films both shot their spooky house in the same house, and that is the Finnis E. Yoakum House in LA. That is my fact.
All right. Good stuff. Good stuff, Ben. James.
So I'm going to keep this relatively brief this week, and you should take this as generosity and recognition of the fact that this is a bumper, extra large podcast and nobody need me filibustering, and not that I may have not put the usual time and effort into preparation of this fact that I normally would. So I want to talk about Friends, the TV series, which of course would find a more natural home on the Pilot TV podcast. But nevertheless, I'm going to bust it out here. And specifically, I want to talk about the title sequence of Friends, which you will recall sees all six of them cavorting in a fountain. Now, that's not just any fountain. That is a very special fountain. It is a fountain on the Warner Brothers ranch in Burbank, where many, many things are shot. Many things are shot. But if you pull back, if you look at some of the wider shots, you will see the buildings behind and the fountain in the foreground looks quite familiar. One of the reasons you may think it looks familiar is because Robert Neville, a.k.a. Charlton Heston in The Omega Man, which we'll remember as an adaptation of Richard Matheson's I Am Legend before, you know, I Am Legend, he lived in the house behind the fountain. In fact, he routinely shot at vampire mutant things with a sniper rifle from the balcony of his house behind that fountain, and he fucking died in that fountain after being impaled by a spear. He did, sorry, spoiler for The Omega Man. Unfortunately, you may not notice then, because as he's bleeding out in the fountain, this water's going red and it's all going horrible, it actually looks a bit different. And that's because they brought in a special stunt fountain for that particular moment. So they didn't actually shoot the death sequence in the fountain in front of the house on the ranch. They did it in a different fountain. But that's where he lived. So that fountain, when you see them, when you watch Friends, when you see the beginning of that iconic sitcom, when you see them all splashing each other in the fountain, I want you to remember that Charlton Heston once bled to death in those very waters, kind of.
Imagine if they were kicking around just his bloodied water, you know?
Yeah.
Like just sharing Robert Neville's blood.
I also like to think that when Robert Neville was shooting with his sniper rifle at the vampires in that fountain, he was also shooting at, you know,
David Ugly Ford. Naked guy.
Yes. Ugly naked guy's a vampire.
Two quick asides. So I once went to Rome to visit the set of Mark Steven Johnson's When in Rome. When in Rome, you have to visit the set of When in Rome, as per the old proverb. And even though Rome is full of incredible fountains, wonderful, wonderful fountains, they had built their own for this one night, this beautiful, extravagant, lavish Roman fountain that wasn't even real, but it was spouting all kinds of water. So that's a quick aside.
Is this because you're not allowed in the proper fountains?
Probably, although
in the Trevi,
yeah, you should never dive into the Trevi.
And the other thing I wanted to say is the reunion of the Friends recently had some behind the scenes footage of them shooting the fountain, the opening
doing
fountain.
What, in the fountain?
Dance. Yeah, they were shooting Charlton Heston in the fountain. They were just stabbing with a spear.
Actually,
it was horrible.
When they're dancing around, they're dancing on his bloody corpse. That's actually what's happening.
They are legend.
Again, as your lawyer, I'd like to make clear that the Friends were in no way dancing on a bloody corpse. And are, as far as we know, not that callous.
I don't know, Helen. The episode title is the one where the Friends dance on Charlton Heston's bloody corpse. So I'm pretty sure it's all there. But yeah, so I hadn't thought of this. I mean, obviously, of course, they would have taken their shoes and socks off to dance in the fountain. Because there was footage of, I think it was Schwimmer with his, or maybe Matthew Perry, with their shoes and socks off. And of course, I just always assumed over the years that they just climbed in fully clothed. But no, they took their shoes and socks off. Anyway, and that's why I don't do the facts.
Yes.
Helen.
Yes, it is.
Hi. Yes. Well, if you had just reversed those two stories, this would have been a lovely segue. Because I was going to tell you a fact about Gina Lollobrigida.
So no
another
way.
Sort of, I know, another Italian starlet of the sort of Dolce Vita era, a little bit later perhaps. Uh-huh. But I wanted to tell you about a thing that happened later in her career, quite recently in her life, really, which was her court case against her purported husband, because she said he wasn't her husband at all. Have you heard about this? So she took up with a Spanish guy, Javier Rigau y Raffles, who
Once
was
again,
23. I'm sorry, who was 23 when she was 57. which he said at the time was a perfect age between a man and a woman. Their relationship went public in October 2006, where he told Hola magazine, which is yes, hello magazine in Spain, Gina is my life. I have been in love with her divinely during all these years. And she said, I have always had a weakness for young men. So all seemed well, except that 2 months later, she called off their wedding, which she blamed on intense media scrutiny. And she said, Javier is desperate. Ever since we've announced this wedding, he's been tormented with lies and slander. He can't take any more. He promised that he would always love and respect his former fiance. But there's some confusion after that. So she claims that they were only ever together for 2 years. He said they were together for 22. She said they met in 2004, but there are pictures going back to 2000. And then it gets weirder. So in 2010, Rigau went ahead with their wedding using a proxy for Lollobrigida, which he said was to avoid a media spectacle and that they were happily married and that she knew all about it. She says she only found out about the wedding by chance 3 years later on some documents she stumbled across on the internet. She had signed a power of attorney, which she said he used for the marriage, which she had given him for a completely different legal matter and which had nothing to do with marrying her. So she actually then filed a lawsuit to get this sort of annulled, basically, objecting to the wedding, saying that he was a vile person and that the proxy marriage was a vulgar fraud. He then threatened to countersue on the basis that she was obviously dragging his name through the mud. And it went through several years of court cases, basically. And in 2017, she lost her court action and the marriage's existence was upheld. And she said she will appeal, but I haven't heard anything more about that yet. But yeah, so that's all really there is to it. It's a bizarre marriage by proxy, which apparently, in her account at least, took the bride entirely by surprise.
Sure, Helen, but did anyone die in a fountain?
Did a house burn down due to alleged demonic activity?
Both things, probably.
What?
Yeah.
How do you
marriage
get
married by proxy, people? If you can't be bothered with the stress and difficulties of a wedding, just send somebody else to do it for you. Job done. So yeah, so as things stand, basically the court rejected her claim that she didn't know what the power of attorney was for, that she didn't know about the proxy wedding, and that they've basically accepted his account of events. So that is where things stand now. But what a weird thing to have happened, you know, and what a strange case to have come forward.
You're not the only one who has a Gina Lollobrigida fact. I have
Please,
just looked at the Wikipedia page. Which ends with, Lollobrigida has a habit of referring to herself in the third person.
So you think she wrote that sentence?
Does Chris Hewitt think that Gina Lollobrigida wrote that sentence? Chris Hewitt wouldn't like to say. All right, so three good facts. Well, two good facts and Ben's fact. No, Ben's fact was good.
Ben's fact was
just
good.
Just a joke. Ben's fact was good. It was good. I don't like it when there are good facts, when they're really, you know, there's like a cigarette paper's width between your facts. It's really hard for me to choose. But I will say, I don't like to give points to James, but I have to give the point to James this week.
That's because my fact was the best. Thank you to @GreenBrendo on Twitter for delivering that one.
I'm sourcing again.
Crowdsourced and a TV fact. A TV fact that was crowdsourced.
Yes. It was a TV film crossover, Ben. It was the perfect synergy of Empire and Pilot.
Unbelievable.
If it helps to know this, that the Griswolds house is also on the Warner Brothers ranch, as is the Lethal Weapon house as well. The Murtaugh's house is there too.
Yep.
Yeah, and many others.
Yep. And, of course, Charlton Heston cameoed in Friends.
Yeah, as we've talked about, his bloodied corpse in the title sequence.
At one point, you can see Chandler just stomping up and down on top of his head, going, could he be any more dead? Anyway, that is it. Okay, so that is it for the three-fact structure. And because it's a bumper-sized, jam-packed edition, we have four guests this week. Four guests. The first one is the wonderful Mila Jovovich, who is the star of Monster Hunter. Yes, indeed, Monster Hunter, the latest movie she's made with her husband, Paul W.S. Anderson, incontrovertibly the best Paul Anderson. And this is an adaptation of the beloved video game franchise. So there you go, in which Mila Jovovich plays someone who hunts monsters. I think I've pretty much nailed the plot. of the film there for you. Now, Helen, for it is she,
yes,
did this interview way, way back in
about
the dark
65
times.
65 months ago, yeah.
Yes, January, in fact.
Was it? Cool. I seem to remember her being lovely, but honestly, I mean, I think I was there. That's all I can remember.
You were there. You were there.
I was there.
She
cool.
was there.
Cool.
It was on Zoom, so again, we have some sound issues with this, but if you're willing to stick with it, you're going to get Mila Jovovich being perfectly lovely, and Helen was also present. So here we go. Do please enjoy.
Hi, Helen.
Hey, Mila. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. So yeah, how are things? How are you surviving 2020?
Well, listen, you know, I'm definitely luckier than most people. You know, it's been really crazy here in America. So yeah. I definitely am lucky to have my family and everyone's safe. So, you know, just count my blessings.
Absolutely. And look, I have to thank you because I watched the film last night. I enjoyed it. And I am just so glad to see things blow up on the big screen again. I mean, you know, I've loved watching like dramas and the kind of indie movie that, you know, has kept coming out this year and they've been great. But I also really miss this kind of just big, fun action movie. It's so good to see it.
Well, listen, it's definitely, if you like these kind of movies, it's an incredible one. I mean, it's huge and my goodness, like the filming of it was so exciting and the places we went, the locations we filmed at, I mean, everything you watch on that screen is pretty much 99% real. And the monsters are obviously made in a computer, but every location was real. Everything was practical. So it was as exciting to film as it is to watch.
That's amazing. Had you been to those deserts like Namibia and South Africa, right? So had you been there before?
Well, I'd been to South Africa before, but never to the locations that we had filmed in. I mean, we were driving hundreds of miles from any human habitation and staying in tent villages. And, you know, it was these really untouched, unfilmed parts of the world that looked so much like the video game and really looked like these alien landscapes. It was amazing, you know, just super extreme. I mean, you understand why nobody lives there because it's just impossible. You know, you've got, you know, 50 degrees centigrade during the day and below zero at night, crazy insects and bugs and arachnids. And it was quite an adventure.
Oh my God, it sounds like no acting required in that case.
Well, you know, in a way it was. You know, I think a lot of these kind of movies, you end up filming on a stage, on a green screen, and, you know, everything is just about like imagining it and pretending. But it was great because Paul really took us to such crazy places and made us work for it to such a degree that it was very easy to connect with our characters and connect with the struggles that we were going through in the script because we were actually going through them in real life. Mm.
What kind of temperatures are we talking? Because it looked crazy out there.
Well, definitely it was definitely over 120 degrees Fahrenheit, which I don't know what that is in centigrade, but I feel like 50 degrees centigrade, at
good
least.
Lord.
Look that up. What's 50 degrees centigrade? 50 centigrade. Yeah, are you kidding? 50 centigrade. Yeah, 122 degrees. I mean,
wow.
This was normal. And, you know, the fact is, of course, in this movie, there's a lot of explosions. There's a lot of gunfire. There's a lot of, you know, things on fire. So, of course, on top of these kind of temperatures, we would be standing next to like burning vehicles and fires everywhere. And so, I mean, it was just stifling, especially in our combat gear and in our armor with all the costumes on. It was crazy.
So, I mean, you know, I heard that from the production notes that you took some convincing to get involved in this film. I mean, I'm guessing it wasn't, you know, any hesitation to work with the director. You guys obviously have a very good relationship. But what was the hesitation? Was it, you know, did you not know the game at that point? Were you not sure? What was it that made you wonder?
You know, for me, I guess we had just wrapped up Resident Evil and I was fighting zombies and to... you know, Paul had never, he'd been involved with this game for over a decade, and he'd been doing different iterations of the script. And, you know, me being the star was never a question with any of them. I mean, at one point he had written it for like a 14-year-old boy. So I just never, he had never said anything to me about me being in the movie. And, you know, and of course I just thought for sure, like after fighting zombies, he's not going to have me fighting monsters now. I mean, it's ridiculous kind of.
You've done your job.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It just felt like, I don't know. It just felt like funny or strange or just like, I don't know. I just like people are going to be like, really? I mean, again, like doing this. But, you know, he had me read the script, and, you know, I mean, definitely he's my husband in the sense he knows what I like, and he knows the kind of characters I'm drawn to. And to have me play a female Army Ranger was definitely something that I've always wanted to do. You know, I come from a long line of military families on both my father and my mother's side. So I always joked if I wasn't an actress that I probably would have joined the military myself, just to keep in the tradition. And so, you know, it was just a really great opportunity for me to be able to play a soldier. Mm-hmm. And you know, but at the same time, I said to Paul, I said, listen, why don't you just like open your circle a little bit? I mean, you know, there's so many other actresses in Hollywood that would be happy to kill monsters for you. Like, you know, give me a chance to like find other scripts and do other things, you know, after killing zombies for so many years, like I need a little bit of a break too. But I'm, you know, in the end, I'm so happy that I did it. And it was such an incredible experience. And, you know, I love him so much for always thinking about me and wanting to work with me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's great that way that you get to kind of hang out together on set, I suppose. But I mean, and tell me about Artemis, your character, because, you know, she's very different from, you know, Alice, most obviously in the Resident Evil movies. Like this is a soldier. She's very grounded, and she feels really tough, but also, you know, she's massively out of her depth in a way that, you know, very few of your characters have a comfortable life, but, you know, she seems to have a particularly difficult one.
You know, the thing that I loved about this character was her relatability and the fact that she was a real woman. You know, there, you know, in the past with Alice, with Lilu, they were these bigger than life kind of supernatural characters that were almost like animated or like straight out of a comic book. And that has its place for sure. But, you know, to be able to play a woman who's just extraordinary, but still real and still relatable, you know, was so much fun because I got a chance to train with amazing teams of soldiers at an army base outside of Los Angeles doing these incredible like combat simulations. And I got to meet a real female Army Ranger who I became friends with and, you know, talked to for hours and days and weeks, you know, just talking about her experiences and what it was like to go through the ranger test to have to like go through all of that training, you know, what made her do it and how it was to survive that. And, you know, there's only a few hundred women have been able to pass the and get their ranger tags. So she really is like a real life superhero. So it was interesting for me to actually to talk to somebody that has been able to survive so much and to do such extraordinary things in her life, but still be a normal person and a really wonderful, funny, pleasant, you know, great human who's a mother and just somebody who's a friend, you know, but at the same time, she's extraordinary. So it gave such a reality to the character for me, and it really gave me something to hold on to that was very close to my heart and you know, that I very much empathized with.
Yeah, she sounded amazing just reading about her. My God, to have gone through all of that. And you know, poor Artemis like goes through quite a lot as well. I like that she didn't instantly, you know, realize that they were in another world. You know, I felt like that was kind of a realistic in a way that sometimes these films aren't. You know, they're just like, oh, we're in a different dimension. Something must have gone wrong. Instead, you know, this film felt very grounded in those early scenes. And then, of course, a gigantic monster erupts from the sand. No spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there was a lot of talks about how to deal with that, you know, especially when, you know, the Captain Malou, who was the Army Ranger who I'm friends with, and she came with her husband to South Africa to be our military advisor and to train all of us on how to act like a team and really, you know, feel like a team that worked together many times before. You know, that was so many of the questions that I asked her was like, really, like, what would you do in this situation? Like, what would you say? Because like, you're not just gonna be like, oh, you know, we must have gone into another dimension. I mean, come on, like, how would you actually react to this? Because, you know, this is crazy. You know, you start in one place and suddenly, you know, your brain would naturally be trying to like normalize things as much as possible. You know, it takes a lot for people to, you know, people aren't just going to go, oh, of course it's aliens. You know? You know, like you would think it's anything but aliens. It's anything mm-hmm. but monsters. Like I'll try and normalize it, you know, till the day I die before I admit that something supernatural has happened, you know?
And what's it like working with monsters as opposed to zombies? Like, you know, is it a very different scale of effects? Is it a very different feel? Or did this feel like, oh, it's another day at the office. I'm fighting a gigantic, awful thing.
Listen, I mean, doing the kind of films that I do never feels like a day at the office, period. You know, it feels like entering into a magical universe. It's makes me, you know, it's something that I feel like my whole life as a kid, I was always like looking for a doorway into another world and reading books about magic and fantasy and sci-fi. And so to be able to live it, you know, as a job is extraordinary because, you know, it's like this, it really answers to that kind of escapist part of myself that always wanted to live in these alternate universes and stuff. But you know, on the technical side, like logistically speaking, you know, when we did like Resident Evil, of course the zombies were people and sure. actors that you could interact with. So there was a lot more stunt rehearsal involved in that sense. You know, if you did have to fight with one of these creatures, you know, you'd have a stunt person that you would have a choreographed routine. You know, timing was, you know, always the key because you don't want to actually hurt anybody or get hurt yourself. You know, with this, it was different because, of course, you know, we didn't have real monsters. But the great thing was Paul really was able through, I think, the locations, especially because the locations were real and because we really had to survive like the extremes that we went through. We kind of were already halfway in that world already as actors, but then also he would come up with things like one of the things that he did to make it more real for us was he created these like sand cannons, and you'd have like the guys responsible for the sand cannon. So every time like the quote unquote monster would run by us, they would shoot sand cannons at us. That would be like tons of sand being blown straight at you, which would like make you fly back because of the velocity and the weight of it. And, you know, so you would actually feel like this monster was like running at you or stomped right next to you because there'd be this huge explosion of sand. And, so that made it so much more interactive in that sense, yeah. Made it easier for us to imagine like how extreme the situation would be in reality.
speaking of extraordinary people to work with and things to work with, Tony Jaa, you get to, you know, fight alongside him. That's pretty incredible. Were you, you know, you've done a lot of action in your career, but, you know, how did you feel kind of going on set next to that guy?
I have to say it was one of the most humbling experiences in my career to work with Tony because, you know, he literally, you know, he is like a magical person in himself. Like, you know, he can do everything that he does in the movies in real life. Like he, you know, he doesn't use wires. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't need like all of that. Like when he does all of those crazy butterfly kicks and spins and things, he doesn't do it on wires. He actually does it himself. So to be able to do these stunt rehearsals with him and see him doing these moves over and over again, I mean, it felt like the guy just has unlimited stores of energy, and the power that emanates from him is unreal. It was incredible to be able to work alongside of him and watch him work and learn from him and just, you know, be able to like fight with him. And, you know, it was incredibly humbling and just so exciting. I mean, my goodness. Yeah. And, you know, on top of all of that, he's just like such a fun person and such a down to earth, like cool guy. You know, we'd be talking and, you know, he would like do a backflip and then go into like some Thai rap. And, you know, he was just so much fun, you know, such a great energy on set. And especially when you're in these crazy extreme locations and, you know, it's not easy. I mean, you know, you don't have like the creature comforts around you. You have to walk like through the sand for, you know, half a mile just to get to like the porta potty. You know, it was everything was like an effort on set, you know, and to have somebody be so chill and happy and smiling and just a great energy is so important because you don't want to have to deal with like diva behavior and people complaining all the time. And I mean, of course, it's so easy to complain, but you know, it's the fact is everybody has to work together and it's hard for everyone. So, you know, you just have to kind of laugh at the situation and enjoy yourself. And Tony is one of those people. So I was super grateful. I mean, everybody that we worked with actually just was such team players and really were so wonderful and sweet and understanding and just game for the whole adventure, you know?
Absolutely. How was his rapping?
I have it. I wanted to post it on Instagram, but you know, I never actually asked his permission to. So I have to DM him and see if he'll let me. But it was amazing. Are you kidding? You should look him up on YouTube because I think he's fully like a singer too. Like he's got like crazy videos.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That sounds incredible. Well, listen, thank you so much. Fingers crossed that there are more monsters to hunt in your future. you know, you're racking up the kills now. It's got to keep going.
Thank you.
Cheers. Nice talking to you.
Great evening.
You too. Cheers. Bye.
So that was Mila Jovovich. We will be discussing Monster Hunter later in the show. And if you like more Monster Hunter conversation, Lynn Helen also recorded a spoiler special chat with the film's director, Paul W.S. Anderson. And that, along with some of us giggling idiots talking about the movie, will be available for spoiler special subscribers in the next couple of weeks. So there you go. All right, so now it is time to tackle this week's question, which comes from at DJ Buds or Buddes on Twitter. DJ Buddes is how he spells his name. And he asks, movies where the main character has gone on a break or is missing at a vital stage of the show. So this is, you know, because I went away last week, you see, because I'm the main character.
God, what have you encouraged, DJ? Seriously.
Yes, thank you, DJ. Chris Hewitt. So, any answers for this one, folks? Movies where the main character has gone on a break or disappeared from the action. Now, I don't think, again, let's lay down some ground rules. I'm taking this not to mean movies in which the main character gets killed unexpectedly halfway through and then another character takes over as a protagonist. I'm talking about movies where there is a main character and then the main character disappears or becomes something other than the main character for a while and then comes back to themselves, but they're still there at the end of the movie.
What about resurrections, though?
Okay, well, throw them at me. Throw them at me and then we'll discuss them.
I mean, if we take the Lord of the Rings as one movie, then Gandalf, arguably, it's probably not the case, but it's arguable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is arguable. Is it arguable that he's the main character, though?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's the bit I'm saying is arguable.
Okay, well, let's argue it.
Well, okay then.
Okay, I mean, you start.
He has the ring at the... Oh, no, he doesn't have the ring at the beginning, but he gives the ring to Frodo.
Ben, have you seen these movies?
Lord of the what?
He oversees the giving of the ring to Frodo. He identifies the ring for what it is. He leads or guides the quest to Rivendell. He sort of manipulates the formation of the Fellowship, at least to some extent. He leads the Fellowship.
Yeah.
And then he falls into darkness, you know, fighting Mr. Sooty Dude. And then, you know, comes back like leveled up, ready to take it on again.
Crucially, when he comes back, he's boring.
How dare you? He's Gandalf.
Yeah, Gandalf the Grey
is better than Gandalf the White.
He also does like fuck off during the Hobbit movies, but in the sense there, you know, at least we do see the side quest, so that probably doesn't count.
Helen, we all checked out during the Hobbit movies. He's not allowed.
Do you know what? I rewatched them recently, and while everything I ever said about them, you know, being unnecessary still stands, they are well made. I will give them that. But it's just the way every single sort of throwaway line of action is turned into a 10-minute fight scene that I think I find quite irritating
at times. It's almost as if they tried to take a very small children's book and stretch it over three gargantuan movies.
Yeah, it is a bit like that. It is.
Look, let's get back to the question, which is characters that disappear for large portions of the film. I'm saying Kevin Bacon in Hollow Man.
Oh boy.
All right. Okay. Yeah. There he is, Captain Pedant. There he can be applying his powers of grammar once again. He's come down on this question.
I have.
He's given it a good scene too. Of course, the movies is James. It is movies where the character has gone on a break or is missing.
Amy Dunn in Gone Girl.
That's a good call.
That's a good one. That's a good one. All right.
Although, is she the main character before
it's
that?
It's literally called Gone Girl.
No, but that doesn't matter.
That's not how it works. That's not the naming convention.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's a film that does a difficult thing in that it shifts protagonists, but like it's not... I don't think she's the protagonist and then disappears. I think she isn't the protagonist and then sort of arguably maybe reappears. To some degree becomes one. Yeah.
Question, can you be the protagonist and not be the main character?
Technically, I'm sure you can, but I'm trying to think of an example. Yes.
I mean, one of mine might fall into that category. One of the ones that immediately sprang to mind for me was Shoshana, Melanie Laurent's character in Inglourious Basterds. She is easily, for me, the main character. The movie begins with her. It ends with her. She is the one who does all of the inciting incidents of the film. And yet, as far as the sort of marketing and everything for that film was concerned, Brad Pitt was the main character of that film, even though he's in it, I think, for less amount of time than her. Obviously, you have that whole La Louisienne section of the film, which is totally incredible, but just like a full half an hour sequence away from Melanie Laurent and everything else that's happening in the sort of Nazi hunting action. So that one really stood out to me. The other one that also might kind of come into this category is I've fairly recently, for the first time, watched The New World, Terrence Malick's The New World, and Captain John Smith. Obviously, this is the sort of Pocahontas story, and for so much of that film, you are following Captain John Smith, played by Colin Farrell. He is sort of one of the pioneers who meets Pocahontas, but then halfway through, or about two-thirds of the way through, he's like, I'm just going to fuck off on a boat. And we stick with Pocahontas.
Actual line of dialogue, folks.
I know, I thought Malick sort of lost his touch with that bit, to be honest, because the rest of it's really realistic. And then
in the Irish accent, I'm going to fuck off on a boat, if that's right with you.
Felt like authentic Colin Farrell, if not authentic Pocahontas story.
Yes.
But yeah, and then from there, Christian Bale comes in and she has a kid with Christian Bale, but he does pop up at the end. Captain John Smith, they sort of meet up in England and he's like, do you know what? I maybe regret fucking off on that boat. So that for me was a clear example of like main or at least very, very central character who's in it for a lot of the film and then buggers off for the last hour and pops up 5 minutes from the end. Okay, another one where it's not the central character, but like a main character. This is going to be your spoiler warning for Sound of Metal. And I'm going to give you a few seconds, if you've not seen Sound of Metal, to pause this podcast and go and watch Sound of Metal or skip forward. I'll keep it fairly brief. This is your spoiler warning. Okay, everyone's gone. Lou, the Olivia Cook character in Sound of Metal, I thought it was so impactful that obviously you're with her and Riz Ahmed's character for the first, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, half an hour of that film. You really get to know the rhythms of their relationship. And then when he goes to the community of deaf people, part of the stipulation of that is that she has to leave. And when he goes to see her again, when they catch up, she is completely changed. She has effectively sort of become a different person. And he arguably has too. So I thought that was a really interesting, obviously Riz Ahmed's character is the central character of that. But I was thinking of main characters who are established at the start of the film as like, this is a big central character of this film who then just leaves.
That feels different to me. That feels like he's the protagonist and he goes off and essentially on his adventure is the wrong word in that case, horrifically so, but his journey. And then when they meet again, they're both different people. That doesn't feel to me like a, you know, it's not like the case where I feel like the question is more the guy who pops up again with the guns at the end, having been pretty much forgotten about. Like there's a character in Nobody, arguably, who fits that template. Again, no spoilers, but sort of not a main character, but there's a side character who sort of disappears long enough that you've kind of forgotten that they exist. And then boom, guns.
Yeah. I mean, this is a tricky question to answer, actually, isn't it? Especially in the confines of a movie. I think Jimbo may be weighing in soon with some TV examples, because it's easier in a TV show over the course of a long season, whether it's, you know, 6 episodes or 23 episodes, you can have an actor go on hiatus for a while. You know, both Mulder and Scully left the X-Files, for example.
Yes, they did.
You know, so you could do that. It's more difficult within the confines of a 2-hour movie for your main character to leave the movie and then come back and still be the main character without, of course, being killed. I have a few examples, though.
Sure.
I'm going to throw at you. You will not be surprised to know that one of those examples is Evil Dead 2.
What?
Because in that movie, there is a portion of that movie, at least 5 minutes, maybe even 10 minutes, where Ash, played by Bruce Campbell, becomes possessed by the Deadeye Force, and the movie hands over protagonist duty to Annie, and Ash becomes the threat for a good chunk of screen time. So there's one. Don't worry, it all works out in the end for Ash. But that is definitely, that's one. Another one I'm going to suggest of Chris's grab bag of movies I'll constantly name on the podcast, The Shawshank Redemption. And again, you can have a discussion about whether Red or Andy is the main character. Red narrates it. Red ends it. But Andy is, I would argue, the main character of the movie. And there's a point in the movie, I don't know if you've seen The Shawshank Redemption, but there's a moment where Andy Dufresne disappears from the narrative of the story, and he disappears from the narrative from his friends' lives as well in the Shawshank prison. And Red takes over the protagonist duties of that one. So I would throw Shawshank Redemption in there as well. There's also there's a portion of John Carpenter's The Thing where Mac is off screen for a little bit. They're trying to up the tension levels and up the suspicion levels. Is Mac one of the things? Has he been subsumed? Has he been assimilated by this beast? And I'm also going to throw in Indiana Jones, the Temple of Doom, because there's a point in that where Indiana Jones is essentially possessed and becomes some sort of weird zombie Indiana Jones. And that's a good chunk of screen time. Once again, that's a decent chunk of screen time. I'm going to throw in Possession and say Possession counts, because Indy, even though Indy is on screen at that point, once again, he becomes the threat. Once again, the protagonist duties in that 10-15 minute chunk of the movie pass to Short Round and to Willie Scott. So I'm going to say that one. And we've been remarkably restrained so far, but not really mentioning the MCU, but I would say Black Panther. There's a point in that movie where T'Challa is off screen. Again, it's a good 5 to 10 minute chunk. And then he comes back all triumphant and all heroic and ready to kick ass. So that would be my MCU vote.
Captain America doesn't turn up until a good like half hour into Avengers Infinity War, you know, which was confusing. So maybe that as
the
well.
Main character of the MCU.
The main
in
character
Helen's
of
head.
The MCU, yeah.
James, do you have any suggestions for this one?
Serious suggestions? None that I have not already given you. No, not really.
No TV people who've left.
But as you say, it doesn't really count. Like, because as you said, people disappear for periods of time in TV shows all the time. It's almost par for the course.
Like Starbuck disappeared in Battlestar Galactica for a bit.
Indeed, indeed, and then returned. Or did she?
Or did she?
I still don't know what happened there. I don't think the writers do either.
Yeah, not entirely clear. Was she an angel? It's never really made clear.
Commander, is it Sheridan in Babylon 5?
Yes, indeed.
Travels in time, it's a whole thing. He came back anyway, it was cool. But
and then obviously Sinclair vanishes completely, but yeah. With good reason.
It's obviously very brief in terms of like episode time, but Buffy is gone for a while. She is dead, and they're trying to figure out what to do without her. And they have the Buffy bot kind of taking the place. Yeah. Obviously that kind of is quite quickly resolved in terms of screen time.
I would say that there are significant portions of Endgame where the main character Thanos isn't present on screen.
I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have brought it up.
It's because in true Crank 2 style, he was dead, but then he got better sort of in the past.
Yeah.
Anything else? Any more? Like I say, this is a tricky one. It's a tricky question, DJ Bettis, but I think we've given it a good old go.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can argue about practically all TV shows. I mean, you know, the moving to the campaign in The West Wing meant that the actual president took a bit of a backseat in some episodes. But, you know, he wasn't gone. He was just kind of sharing a bit.
Every season of The Wire means that you can sort of follow different characters, but then they come back. Obviously, Presbyluski is major in season one, but then it's not really until season four, is it, that he comes back? Mm.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The biggest departure in The Wire is McNulty in season two, who is barely in it.
Of course.
Yeah.
He's barely in season four as well, isn't he? He's
much
in it
less
more,
so, yeah, because that's much more about Prez and the school kids.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one. The main character of, I mean, the Fast and Furious franchise has got by without its main character, Han Solo, for a couple of movies now. So they're about to rectify that big time, which is good.
Yes.
It's exciting stuff.
Vin took the whole of two off and almost all of three off before returning.
Mm-hmm. He did. Yeah. What a boon. What a boon for everybody. Well, listen, I think we've answered our question to the best of our ability. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire podcast as DJ Bedis, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right. If I'm not, then please do let me know. Found to his cost, get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Hewitt. Slide into my DMs or just reply to one of my tweets or wait for a panicked shout out every now and again. Although, again, I must stress, I think we're good for the next couple of weeks. I think we have some questions in the old question bank. And it's time to round off the first part of this two-part episode with our second guest this week. It is Reese Shearsmith. Not on to talk about the latest triumphant series of Inside Number 9, oh no, although we do talk about that a little bit. He's here to talk about his latest collaboration with Ben Wheatley. They've worked together in the past on a field in England in which something terrifying happened to Reese Shearsmith in a tent, and High Rise in which nothing terrifying happened to Reese Shearsmith in a tent, but Reese Shearsmith was pretty terrifying in that movie. And now they're back with this week's very weird, very scary In the Earth, in which, yes again, something weird happens with Reese Shearsmith in a tent. He wasn't in a tent, thankfully. When I talked to him on Zoom a couple of weeks ago, he was in his home. Much safer. Much safer. Always have a blast talking to Reese. He is good people. Here we go. Do please enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the star of In the Earth, Mr. Reese Shearsmith. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. It's good to have you here. How has been your pandemic, Reese? Because you've been very busy, not least, of course, making this movie.
Yeah, it's been, you know, I'm very lucky to, when I was unable to act, because we were 3 days into filming series six of Inside Number 9, and we had to stop it due to the plague. And then we were in the lockdown time, but we were very fortunate because we knew we had series seven to have to write. So we immediately started writing. So now we've got this break, let's get ahead of ourselves and start writing some new episodes, because of course Number 9 never seems to end. So it's just relentless content of new stories. So we would try, we wrote some more episodes throughout the summer and March, April, May. And then in the meantime, suddenly in the earth started to creep up as well. And that was going to happen, but I never really quite believed it. So I've been fine because I was writing all the way through. Yeah. And then I did some acting with Ben in the middle of the summer, right in the middle of the lockdown. I think we were the first people to creep out and do it. But so I was very lucky because it never really felt like, you know, despite the fact that acting seems to be the most frivolous, non-essential item, we were able to continue, you know, safely and carefully. And it's been a godsend to think that we've, and then when I wasn't doing that, I was writing. So I've been busy. I've not been completely sort of like a caged animal. And anyway, I don't go out anyway, Chris, so it doesn't matter to me.
You don't?
No, I'm in all the time.
You're hermetically sealed.
Yeah, nothing changed.
It's a writer's life, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very sedentary, solitary. I mean, I've got Steve, so we do meet, and we meet in an office, and that was strange because we wrote remotely, which we've never done before. So we were on a Zoom, on a call with a FaceTime and the page, that final draft up on both of our computers. And we wrote like that, and that was very, we've never done it before. It was very strange because it concentrated the mind, but it wasn't much fun, I don't think, because you realise a lot of writing is when you're not writing. It's the off bits and you do the chat before and after, and the fact that you're sort of procrastinating, that's where you start to think, and you're chatting away and thinking of things. And it makes you very much an island, doesn't it, when you're on Zoom. You're just this, it boils down the essentials of why you're there. You said there's no sort of getting around it. It's like, right, let's get to work. So I suppose it distilled our work ethic. We worked hard, probably shorter hours in the day than we would have done in real life, because it was like, it was exhausting. Yeah, we would start in the morning, 9, 10, and then we would be done at 2 or something. We'd sometimes be done at 11 or go, right, forget it, it's too hot or whatever it might be. So, but we managed to get some more episodes done. So series 6 and 7 ended up being a mismatch, sort of mix and match of episodes that were going to be series 6 and 7. So it's all been a bit jumbled up according to what we filmed, because they suddenly wanted them. BBC ran out of content and they were like, can we please have them? Because they were repeating 1989. All of it in its entirety from the beginning.
I noticed that, yeah, with live commentaries as well.
Yes,
so did you find that the real life situation, the pandemic, was beginning to seep into number 9 as you were writing it?
Well, we had an adverse reaction to it because we very quickly, when we looked and saw everything was being made and dramas were being created with Zoom calls and things, and is Amma turned on? And all those stupid jokes that people were making, thinking they were the first to make them. We thought,
well, someone was. Someone would have been the first person to make that joke.
Yes, someone did it. And it was very funny when it happened, but then not the 900th time you see it on another incarnation.
True.
So we were very quick to think, don't do that. That would tire very quickly and become very much of its time. And we didn't want to look like we were just, you know, we were always trying to think to make them special, and we just thought it will be such a done thing to if it finally arrives on TV and it's a Zoom one. Inside Number 9 is claustrophobic, and you know it's suited to exactly this situation, I guess. I think people were expecting oh my god, is it going to be a lockdown one? No, because you expect it. So we very quickly jettisoned it to think, well, let's not do the obvious. There was a time nearly when we thought of an idea. And the BBC said, will you do one? And we had something that was quite good, and then we didn't do it because it just got, we then even thought it's just past the point of it being, you know, it current. And we just thought it's not, no one wants to see it. Everyone's in it for real life. It's too soon. You're in it during it. You don't want to be, I know there's mirroring life, but that was, you don't want that thrown back at you. So we didn't. We went actively the other way, and we filmed, like, you know, the episodes that are going out now, you wouldn't know that we were socially distant. We didn't have to socially distance. It wasn't like EastEnders where you see them like, why are they not? Why is that at the back of a doll's head? Or whatever it might be. Why is that man kissing a doll? Oh, right. It's because he can't go near the lady.
Yeah.
So we were just, very much reacting against it. And we just thought, let's just do some good stories, take people out and away of this and not dwell on it. Ben, however...
Well, Ben has leaned into it in a really interesting way. I railed in the early weeks of the pandemic on the podcast. I railed against the prospect because I know how the industry works, and I know that it's going to be a ton of very bleak, you are there pandemic dramas. And I love Paul Greengrass, but if he makes a pandemic drama, it's going to be like wading through treacle for me. And I love the man and I love his work, but that's going to be a hard sit. But the really interesting work for me that's resulted from the pandemic have been things like Rob Savage's Host, which takes it as a jumping off point. And Ben does that and goes in this really weird, phantasmagorical, surreal, allegorical science versus nature route with within the earth. And that must have been something he said to you from the off.
He did. I mean, I marvel at Ben that he can keep it all in his head, because it's none of it's by accident, you know, and he very much had a plan right from the start as to what this would be. I mean, it's so many different things, isn't it? The film starts out like some sort of weird, like Midnight Run, and then in the middle it's Texas Chainsaw, and the end it's Quatermass. You know, it's very, it goes very different in a place you never would think. And he was inspired by, he's always great. I mean, he knows not to make, he doesn't try to attempt to make a film in 14 days if it's Spider-Man. You know, he couldn't do it, but he knows he can do, the limitations are the thing of it. And he embraced the challenge. I think he needed to write it. He's one of these people that have got so many plates spinning and he can do lots of projects. I'm terrible. I can't do that. I don't know how he does it, but he's got all these different notions. And I think it just occurred to him that he felt like, how can you do anything that doesn't address this now in this world that we're in, that's had this thing? And like you say, it was a jumping off point, because then it gets into, like you say, science and storytelling, and the fact that we as creatures have to give ourselves an explanation and a narrative of what was going on. And in extreme times, it's strange to where people's minds will go to sort it out for themselves, you know? I think Zach is an example of, he's worked it. That's his explanation, is what he's doing in the woods and why it's happened. He's got it all sorted in his head, and it's a very, it's strange because it's a very earthy sort of religious sort of route, where his counterpart, Dr. Wendell, is the science version of it. So you meet these two people that have got very opposing explanations for the narratives that humans tell themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Zach has stumbled down many rabbit holes, and what has emerged on the other side is terrifying. He obviously doesn't have a Wi-Fi connection in this movie, but I imagine if he did, he'd be on some sort of deep web message board pontificating.
Yeah. I think he probably believes in a lot of conspiracy theories, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was great because I had my lockdown beard anyway, and I was like, oh, right, if I'm playing this, then I'll just keep going. Because it seemed right that he would have a beard. But I got the call from Ben in, I think it was April. He said that he was doing something. I said, what are you doing? Because it was just like, what are you doing? And he said, I'm writing a horror. And I was like, oh, great. Well, there's a part in it for me. And he said, there is. So then I was like, oh, fantastic. Well, if that happens, that'd be great. But like I say, I never really thought it would. I thought, this is just therapy for him. It's good. He's writing a nice little horror film for himself. Mm. And we won't do it. And then it slowly but surely, it was coming together. And then in May, and then in June, and then it was the dates set in August. And I was like, are we really actually? And then there were COVID tests, and it was actually happening. And he got together a crew, and we were this little bunch of 25 people that went out into the world. And it was such an extraordinary experience. I mean, it was very much Field in England experience all over again, because it was outside, and it was, you know, it felt like Zach is definitely a descendant of Whitehead. In fact, his surname in the script is Zach Whitehead.
Oh, really? So
there is definitely a link in his mind. I mean, he's very oblique, Ben. He won't ever tell me anything, but that is a certainty, that there is certainly some connection between the two films.
Interesting, because there's an obvious connection as well, which is never get into a tent with Reese Shearsmith in a Ben Wheatley movie.
Yep, even in Bake Off. Which inexplicably I won. But nothing bad happened in that tent. That was just Prue.
You didn't emerge with this frightful look on your face.
Paul Hollywood in the corner.
Yeah, tethered to Paul Hollywood. So what sort of conversations did you have with Ben then about the character? And I don't know if you can see behind me, for example, but there's a poster I've yet to put up because I'm terrible at DIY, but there's a poster of John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, which is another movie about, it's one of my favorite Carpenter films, and it's another movie about the collision between science and nature and faith and religion. And
yes,
and it obviously invokes, you know, his pen name for that movie, he wrote it, was Martin Quatermass as well. So it's a movie, right, that very much goes back to all the Nigel Leal stuff as well.
Yeah.
So were those the templates, the touchstones? There's a little bit of Phase Four in here as well, I'm discerning. Were those the conversations you had with Ben about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not so directly as to like, I'm doing a Quatermass, or I'm doing, I think he never really likes to say I've magpied from this or that, but certainly the films he was watching were those, yeah. And John Carpenter and his very early film work ethic of how quick he made them, I think really inspired Ben to think, well, it's possible to do it. But he definitely wanted to explore a film that ends up being the light and the sound are the thing of it rather than the means to an end. It was like that becomes front and center of your experience of watching the film. You know, there's, I don't want to say anything about the ending, but the sort of the way that we end up in this weird, mad, again, a bit like Field in England, that ends up sort of eating itself as a film. It ends up being this strange. It's a bit like, what's the film with Christopher Walken when he puts the machine on his head and it films his, is it Brainstorm?
Yes.
Remember that film?
Yeah.
It's Louise Fletcher puts it on just as she's having a heart attack.
Yes.
And films dying and going, where you go. That is the sort of what I was thinking of when I was reading the ending. Because at the ending, you know, the film was sort of, to describe what happens in that bit in the script was ridiculous. It was just like one sentence in the script. But then, you know, he's editing this extraordinary visual soundscape journey. I've not seen it. I can't wait to see it in cinema because I'm sure it'll be a great, it'll be an onslaught of the senses, you know.
Yeah, I had the experience.
Did you see it in the cinema?
No, sadly, I wasn't able to. I had that experience of, as I said to Ben, I saw it exactly as you intended on my computer with my name obliterating half the screen. But I did watch it with headphones, and I thought that was a really great experience. I'd love to see it with a bunch of people. I'd love to see it on the big screen, you know, being assaulted by the sound. But being immersed in the soundscape, I thought was really interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I bet that will transport you. I mean, it will be a bit of an endurance test as well, I suspect, which is quite good because that's what is going through. That's what's happening to the characters. So I think you want that sort of, you're going to be there very much with them, wanting to get out of the theatre like they want to get out of that woods. And you can't, you're not allowed.
And without giving too much away, obviously your character Sack is he is the cue for the film to start racing towards its dark heart, shall we say. And what I loved about your portrayal in this is how amiable he is, how reasonable sounding he is, even though the things he's doing are not always reasonable.
Yeah, well, that was definitely because I said to Ben I said how much. And he was onto it straight away because I said, "Shall I really want to play it like I am genuinely going to help them when they meet me in the woods." And I'm a real beacon of light because it's like, fantastic, we're going to get out of here. And he said, yeah, but the audience will think that for about 20 seconds. So, and I suddenly thought, oh, yeah, of course, yeah. I can't really hide it for very long, but I'm not potentially all I seem. So in some way that allowed me off the hook. And yet I never wanted to play it that he was clearly completely psychotic or whatever he might end up being from the beginning. The reasonableness, I think, is one of the scary things about, you know, when you see people that are so sure and calm, that's, and they're saying the most extraordinary sort of the thing you don't want them to be saying about situations. That's when you go, oh no, please, because I don't think I'm going to be able to persuade you any other way. And that's scary because it's like you're unwavering in your what you're going to do to me.
Have you met people like that, or is that something that you've seen proliferate on social media?
Yeah, I would be frightened of such a person. So I thought that's what's good about that, doing it that way rather than screaming and shouting and that's sort of a bit first root and maybe might be frightening for some people, can't bear noise. But ultimately, I think going leaning the other way and playing it quite calm and still was more until he needs to be a bit more, you know, there is final outbursts. But yeah, I just thought that was a better way. And I thought weirdly with his long hair and his beard, he's got some sort of, he's at one with nature. And I think he feels quite contented and, you know, guru-like. And that's very chilling, I think, to think he's got some sort, he's got it sorted in his head and he wants to explain it to you, but you will be, there'll be bending and bowing to make you fit rather than any sort of dialogue.
And you're obviously a student of horror films. You're obviously a student of comedy as well. I wanted to ask about your Bob Bunkhouse experience, because I was watching a documentary about Bob Bunkhouse a few years ago, and it was a, you know what I'm talking about, but I'm putting in context for the listeners. It was one of his, I think one of his last stand-up gigs it was his last stand-up gig, yeah. And you were in the audience. It was a group of young comedians as well. What was that like? Because you guys seemed enraptured by him.
Yeah, he was quite extraordinary. Because, no, we don't, you know, look at it now and it looks like some sort of document of his last stand-up gig. But at the time, it was just he's doing a stand-up gig. And how brilliant. And David Williams said to me, do you want to go and see it? I've got tickets. And I was like, of course, it's going to be amazing to see him. And there he was. It was very, and it wasn't really, I mean, it was sort of stand-up, but it was sort of trip down memory lane. It was very reminiscent and rueful, and it was moving. You know, it was fantastic because I think we knew he was ill, but he was still completely all there. And then in the midst of telling all these stories about Peter Sellers and all these, you know, extraordinary experiences he's had over the film career that he had as well as everything else, he was talking about creating worlds and talking about the goons. And he in the same breath mentioned, as he said, and of course that's the League of Gentlemen. And it was like, oh my God, he's seen it. And I was really blown away that he'd even seen it. You know, I knew that he would know David and John Coleshaw was in the audience and various other people. I thought, you might not have said, I don't think you'll have seen my thing. And he had, and he absolutely referenced it and got it completely. And I thought, of course you have. You're completely a scholar in comedy, and he always was up to date with everything new. And it was just a really lovely moment, because it was like, here's someone that really, you know, knows his onions, and he's commented on our work like it's a thing, like it's a real thing. He still felt quite new then, and like, I don't know if anyone's even watching it, but Bob Monkhouse mentioning it was quite something. Yeah. And it was captured on film, because they filmed it. I didn't know until many years later when it came out in that BBC 4 documentary that they filmed it. And there we all were, like little young fledglings, all listening, enraptured.
And there's I can't imagine what it was like being in that room, because there was something about, you know, the way you and Steve are so specific about your performances and are so specific about your comedy seems to me to chime with Bob Bunkhouse's approach. I mean, the specificity of what he was doing was so meticulous about his approach that you wouldn't think there's a lot of crossover there, but there is to me from the outside looking in.
Yeah, and I think as a scriptwriter as well, he crafted it and honed it and worked it in the way that I hope that we never lightly end up with a final draft. We work and work and work and really try hard to polish and polish. And he was, you know, and I know the criticism of Bob sometimes was that he was too immaculate, but you know, it's that was his style. And I think, you know, you can't get away from how sort of like diamonds he delivered those lines. It was like a science, and he was creating perfect equations of that equals a laugh, you know. And it felt like very much like that was what he was doing. And yeah, very inspirational for us, because he was, the writing is everything, you know. Without the writing, you can get so far with the performance, but I think ultimately you start to see the cracks if it's not well written. And when increasingly in our careers we've gone down the rabbit hole of trying to create more and more amazing jaw-dropping stories, which is becoming a tyranny in its own right, but it's a challenge.
Yeah, it's true. I have views about the prevalence of improvisation in modern comedy. I think there's a time and a place for it, and it's fine, but the Pythons didn't improvise. They got into a room and they absolutely hashed out every single line. pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I think it's you could argue when you're sat in a room toiling away like what we do, there's a version of it where you just go in, you don't do any of that, and you just turn up on the night, and it's just, and you think you've done the same thing. I don't think it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's not. It's not at all. But I just want to ask real, really quick, because obviously, as you mentioned, you and Steve wrote Series 6 and Series 7 pretty much on Zoom. Do you still do that weird ritual where one of you has to find the other dead in the morning, or is that something that you
only yesterday I went into the room to the office because we're meeting up now in real life, and he was in the corner. He wasn't dead. There's a little weird Pierrot mask that we've got in I think it was on the South Bank show about us as well. And he had that on in the corner. He was hiding like at the end of Don't Look Now behind the sofa, just beckoning me in, the little tiny hand movement. So he wasn't dead then, but it was like some sort of weird demon. Just as good.
And at that moment, nature is healing.
Yes, exactly.
Which brings us back to In the Earth. Oh, we're man. Back,
yeah.
Full circle, brings us up. Reece Shearsmith, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Cheers. Take care. And that was Reece Shearsmith, and we will be talking about In the Earth in the second part of this podcast, because that is it for part one of this week's bumper-sized, jam-packed, two-part Empire podcast. Join us whenever you can for part two, in which we will be talking to Jimmy Smits, star of In the Heights, not In the Earth. And you'll be hearing an excerpt from our Godzilla vs. Kong spoiler special interview with that film's director, Adam Wingard, as well. Plus, we'll be talking about all the week's movie news and reviewing a whole bunch of films, including In the Heights, In the Earth, and Luca. Can't say much fairer than that. So don't think of this as a goodbye. Think of this as a brief parting of the ways. See you soon. Bye.